Greetings and welcome. I'm Dr. Mark Pfeiffer, chair of the 66th Annual Wills Eye Hospital Alumni Conference, which was held here in Philadelphia last week. This is a collaborative effort between Medscape and Wills Eye Hospital. We're going to be speaking to some of our residents and fellows who presented original research in a very well-received free paper session that started the conference on Thursday. First, Dr. Michael Rabinowitz from Oculoplastics will tell us about his work on prostaglandin-associated periorbitopathy.
Thank you. So what we are doing is looking at prostaglandin periorbitopathy. It's a syndrome in which the eye sinks into the eye socket because of relative fat loss within the eye socket and around the eye. You get a sinking of the upper eyelid where the superior sulcus becomes hollow. All of the literature that's out there will tell you that the lid can droop as a result of this syndrome. However, our study, in contrast to the vast majority of literature out there, is looking at this in patients treated in only one eye. So we're able to distinguish the changes from this syndrome from the changes in the normal aging eyelid. And what we're finding is that the eyelids are almost universally retracted as opposed to drooping. Mm. This is an important factor because it can distinguish this syndrome from the aging eyelid.
Okay. So this is something associated with prostaglandin use?
Correct.
Okay. Is there anything that general ophthalmologists or glaucoma specialists should be aware of when prescribing prostaglandin analogs for their patients with glaucoma?
Well, I think the most important thing is just to be aware of the syndrome in and of itself. You can have these changes in the eyelids, changes in the orbit and relative enophthalmos that result from the drop. And these are important considerations, especially in the aging patients who already have a loss of orbital fat. Because when they're laying flat in the supine position, the globe can sink back towards the orbital apex, causing separation between the lid and the cornea, which can result in exposure.
Is this especially noticeable when they're only treating one eye?
It is. It is.
All right. Well, thanks, Michael. Next, we have Dr. David Perlmutter, who presented his work on automated analysis of the vasculature in fundus photographs. David, can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Thank you, Dr. Pfeiffer. We collaborated with the Department of Family Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, and our goal was to use a software program called AVRNet to look at vessel changes in fundus photos. Now, these were communicated through telemedicine, and we're hoping that we can show that the changes in the vessel measurements will be useful measures of people's control of hypertension and diabetes.
Interesting. Now, did the automated analysis agree with experts' opinions on the fundus vasculature?
The values that we're measuring, they did agree with the currently published values in the literature. So we think that this software tool will be useful going forward in a long-term study. And the long-term study in the family medicine department is going to look at vascular risk factors, as well as unique tools like finger capillaroscopy. We're hoping to correlate the vessel measurements with these risk factors and with those measurements.
Very interesting. Thank you, David. Now I'm joined by Dr. Murtaza Adam, who presented innovative work on the smartphone ophthalmoscopy reliability trial. Moo?
Thank you, Dr. Pfeiffer. So this study came about because of work done at Emory, looking at the use of fundus cameras that cost about $4,000 to $5,000 in an emergency department. It's hard for ophthalmologists to make it to the ER during a busy clinic, and sometimes patients with vision-threatening or neurologic-threatening conditions have important findings in their eyes missed, and this can be really important in patient care. So this study basically validated that these cameras can be used to really find some significant eye disease in patients who would otherwise have it missed, because most doctors are not that skilled at direct ophthalmoscopy. We soon learned after that study that you can use a simple smartphone with a camera mode and a $200 lens that most ophthalmologists carry in their office or in their call bag, and you can take images, high-quality images, of the ocular fundus. And so we took a look at seeing if this is something that can produce high-quality images and seeing if these images are diagnostically useful. And we also saw if people who were previously untrained in indirect ophthalmoscopy could learn this technique and make photos or take photos that were useful as well. So using the Wills Eye Emergency Department, which is a pretty unique place, there's only three emergency departments in the country like this. We enrolled about 79 patients and basically proved that, you know, with a skilled operator, you can get images that are pretty much the same quality as this normal fundus camera. And those that are not skilled in it, they learn relatively quickly that, you know, using this technique, that they can get probably about a 50% hit rate of critical findings, which is much better than most doctors can with a direct ophthalmoscope.
Now, you were able to take some pretty impressive images of some pathology. Were the patients dilated for this?
Yes, they were. And that is one downside of this technique, is to get an adequate view of the fundus, you need to dilate these patients. So our next steps are trying to take a look at seeing if we can get an image with an undilated view using different lenses and maybe a different light source on the smartphone. And we're working with Drexel University right now on getting that going.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Dr. Adam.
Thank you.
Next, I'm joined by Dr. Margaret Greven, who presented her work using oral eplerenone to treat central serous chorioretinopathy. Margaret, can you tell us about your study?
Yes. So we did a retrospective chart review of patients who had received eplerenone, which is a selective aldosterone antagonist for the treatment of chronic central serous chorioretinopathy. So we reviewed the charts of 12 patients who had received this medication to see the effect on subfoveal fluid and vision over time.
This is usually a disease that's self-limiting, and we typically don't treat and use watchful waiting. How does this treatment have an advantage over traditional observation?
So in our series of patients, all the patients had subretinal fluid for at least 3 months, but the average was 6 months with a range of 3 months to 24 months. So all of these patients had subretinal fluid for a long period of time, and some of them had undergone other treatments to try to resolve subretinal fluid. But eplerenone did show effectiveness in reducing subretinal fluid and improving vision in these patients.
Hmm. Were you able to treat acute central serous as well?
So there was an arm of the study looking at patients with acute central serous chorioretinopathy, and they also showed some benefit from the eplerenone.
Were there any side effects from the medication?
Not in our series of patients, although eplerenone is known to potentially cause hyperkalemia, especially in patients with renal failure or compromise.
Excellent. Well, very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're joined by Dr. Alessandra Antilli, who presented her work reviewing the outcomes of femtosecond laser-assisted cataract surgery performed by residents here at Wills Eye Hospital. Allie, can you tell us a little bit about your study?
Sure. We reviewed the first 100 cases performed by residents here at Wills Eye, and we found the very low incidence of postoperative and intraoperative complications. In fact, we didn't have any posterior capsule ruptures. We also did not have any drop nuclei, and we did not have any anterior capsule tears either.
That's interesting. What does this tell us about incorporating femtosecond laser-assisted surgery in a teaching program?
Well, it tells us that it's safe to do so, and the outcomes are comparable to the manual cataract surgeries that residents perform here on a daily basis.
Do you think there's any advantage to actually having residents start with femtosecond-assisted surgery, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, in fact, the most complicated part for a new resident is performing the anterior capsulotomy. So if we could begin residents on a procedure that performs the capsulotomy for them, they may be able to improve their manual dexterity with phacoemulsification and then move on to the capsulotomy once their dexterity is improved.
Hmm. Now, which laser did you use in this trial?
We used the Optomedica laser.
Very interesting. Thank you, Ellen. Next, we're joined by Dr. Michael Dolan, one of the retina fellows here at Wills, who presented his work on instituting a no-talking policy during intravitreal injections. In fact, Michael won the McDonald Award for the best fellow paper presented at the conference. Michael, can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Sure. Thanks a lot, Dr. Piper. We treat a lot of macular degeneration, diabetic macular edema from other common causes here at Wills Eye on the retina service. And most of these conditions are treated with intravitreal injections. In fact, over the last 4 years, we've performed over 120,000 intravitreal injections. During the last 2 years, we've actually instituted a no-talking policy during intravitreal injections, whereby we try to minimize speech during the injection. The idea is that by minimizing speech, you minimize aerosolization of respiratory droplets, and you create a more sterile field and less risk of contamination and less risk of infection in the eye or endophthalmitis. We compared the last 2 years and our endophthalmitis rates to the preceding 2 years and those endophthalmitis rates prior to implementing this no-talking policy, and what we found was that during the no-talking period we were able to decrease not only overall cases of endophthalmitis by approximately 50%, but also decreased those that were due to oral flora-associated organisms by also greater than 50%, which is consistent with the idea that if you minimize speech, you're minimizing contamination of the...
Now, these infections are very rare, but they can still be devastating when they occur. What is the underlying infection rate for most centers using intravitreal injections with standard sterile policy?
So thankfully, it's very low, depending on the study, in the range of 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 3,000.
Were you able to show that the flora that caused the infections were oral in origin?
They were. So oral flora are typically streptococcal species, and during the no-talking period, we found a significant reduction in endophthalmitis cases due to these oral flora species.
So do you recommend that retinal specialists in the community institute a no-talking policy while they're giving injections?
I certainly think that minimizing speech during intravitreal injections would be a positive thing.
For both the patient and the doctor?
Of course.
Great. Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
We're joined by Dr. Chris Brady, who completed his residency here at Wills Eye and is currently involved in the Retina Fellowship Program. He presented work on using web-based crowdsourcing to evaluate fundus photography in diabetic retinopathy. Chris, can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Absolutely. Thanks, Dr. Pfeiffer. So our work was based on the observation that screening rates for diabetic retinopathy are dismal. We need to be screening twice the number of patients that we're screening now. And if we were to do that, there would be a huge human resources crunch, particularly in emerging economies where diabetic rates are going through the roof.
What is crowdsourcing?
So crowdsourcing is the division of a task into small bits and sort of sprinkling it out to a number of different, perhaps anonymous people on the internet. It doesn't have to be on the internet, just as a term, but in general, crowdsourcing generally now involves people using the internet to do little tiny pieces of work for a small fee.
And these could be anywhere in the world as long as they have internet access.
It could be absolutely anywhere in the world. And I know that on the Amazon interface that we used for this project, they were all over the world.
And these are novice interpreters with no formal training whatsoever.
That's right. I mean, they when they're not sitting there doing my project, they could be doing any number of things. They could be looking at a photograph that maybe has pricing information, writing down the pricing information. They might be looking at a picture and saying whether it has some element that may be inappropriate for, you know, a family or a website for the public.
Right.
But we thought, well, let's see if they can be trained to look at a fundus photo and say whether it's normal or abnormal.
How did you train them?
Well, the key with all of this work is to make sure it's worth it for the person doing it. So it has to be very brief. So we had one web page where there were six training images that they could hover over from normal fundus through a severe fundus, annotated with the different features of diabetic retinopathy. And as I say, they could hover over them to learn about retinopathy. I'm assuming they probably would do that more on the first or second picture they look at, and then as they got more advanced, they wouldn't have to do that anymore.
And then next they would grade a series of images and try to identify what stage of retinopathy each one represented?
That's right. We started out just by asking them whether they thought the image was normal or abnormal. And from the outset, they did fantastic at that. They did, if you averaged 10 graders score, they got about 90% of the first batch of pictures we put up there correctly. When I asked them to grade them as mild, moderate, or severe, again, trying to translate into plain language, they really didn't do much better than chance. But then we made some modifications to the training, and they did quite a bit better.
How did they compare to expert interpreters of fundus photography?
That's a great question, and you know, that's not a trial that we've done as yet. For this study, we compared their grading against two surgeons here as an expert grader, as a gold standard, but I really didn't pit them against other types of graders.
Right.
There's been studies in the literature, for example, from retinopathy of prematurity telemedicine, where they've looked at medical students, people at different stages of their training, and seeing how they do interpreting retinopathy of prematurity photos. I think that'd be something interesting to try here. Because there is also the issue of the resolution of the interface. You know, it may not be that an expert would get the same mark as they're looking at these images on the website.
Do you think this may have applicability in other areas of medical imaging like radiology?
You know, I think there is a role for it. Again, there are some major medical, legal, and even ethical boundaries that would have to sort of be worked out before it was really used clinically. Any diagnostic modality needs to be approved by the FDA. Any sort of imaging modality needs to be tested carefully before it can be used clinically. But I, you know, the only other use that I saw when we did the literature search was for malaria thick blood smear interpretation. Yeah. And that was very interesting, but, you know, I'll tell you, if I look at a chest x-ray now, I think I probably would do a little worse than I'd done a few years in medical school. So I think it would certainly be very interesting.
And it certainly has a cost advantage.
Absolutely. You know, we use 10 graders per image, 10 cents a piece. Amazon gets a 10% commission, so it was $1.10 per image. And there are papers in the literature saying if you want to make a diabetic retinopathy project feasible in the developing world, you've got to keep the cost at about a dollar or two. And so that was kind of our target. That's how we chose that number. And so we think it's a very interesting first step.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. And finally, welcome Dr. Julia Haller, the ophthalmologist in chief here at Wills. Julia, tell us about what else you found out, found interesting of the conference this year.
I thought it was a great conference. Really, I did, Mark. There were a number of highlights. One of them was the media session where we talked about ethical issues and how medicine and specifically ophthalmology can interface better with the media. That was on Friday. But if I had to pick the highlight, it would be the Thursday afternoon session, which was resident and fellow papers. I know we've had a number of little sound bites and clips in this session where some of the speakers have highlighted the main points of their discussions. As a retina specialist, I thought one of the really interesting papers was the one given by Mike Dolan, where he looked at a huge number of patients who were given intravitreal injections pre and post instituting a no-talk rule in the injection room and showed a significant drop in the rate of endophthalmitis. I mean, the rate of endophthalmitis is low to begin with, but just eliminating the chance of particulate spray and mouth flora in the room really dropped it significantly, and we were able to show that in part because such a huge number of intravitreal injections are done here.
And that was keeping everything else the same, the standard infectious precautions with the povidone-iodine prep and a sterile lid speculum, just not having the patient or the physician talk during the injection process.
And one of the points that was made was, you know, how can you inexpensively increase the success of these injections, lower the risk? And one thing that's always debated is masks versus no mask. And this was low cost. There were no masks, but there was just a strict no-talk policy instituted. Hmm. So that was interesting. And then I'd also have to highlight a really groundbreaking study that is in process still through a grant from the Centers for Disease Control that our glaucoma service is doing, where they take everything from the glaucoma clinic, basically, almost everything, to community centers, to underserved populations in the greater Philadelphia area. So it's kind of, I joke that they're taking the mountain to Mohammed because they're actually examining patients, doing visual field tests, finding patients, for example, with narrow angles out in the field, and then doing laser iridectomies right there. And it's astonishing how much pathology they're finding, how many patients who otherwise would not come in to see the physician are being found and treated prophylactically. It's very exciting, and potentially, of course, what the idea here is this could be scaled up as a new approach to reaching the underserved.
As part of that effort, I believe they presented bilateral simultaneous laser peripheral iridotomies and showed they were just as safe as doing them separately.
That was a little bit controversial and occasioned some discussion. That was a very interesting point.
Is there anything about the program here at Wills that supports this type of research and encourages our residents and fellows to get involved that leads to such quality work?
Yes. I think overall there is an atmosphere of the inquiring mind and what can we do to give evidence-based information which will push us into new clinical directions. You notice many of the papers, most of the papers were very clinically focused with clinical research. I think one of the key innovations, though, has been establishment of a new program whereby seed projects are funded through our endowment. It's called the Innovations Grant Program, and many of the residents and fellows who have to be involved in these projects in order for them to be funded, many of them referenced the funding by the Innovations Grants Program, and I think we're seeing that come to fruition. It just shows how just a little bit of funding and the kindness of your philanthropists can make a big difference in resident education and in research.
I'm really impressed by the amount of collaboration with other institutions that happens as well.
We are so lucky here in Philadelphia to have so many outstanding scientific institutions, and WILS, because of our structure as an eye hospital that is Switzerland, if you will, has the ability to do projects with so many of the top investigators in the world, and that's a very exciting thing for us.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a collaborative effort between WILS Eye Hospital and Medscape Ophthalmology. Thanks for joining us.